Well, we're going to be talking about weather with Steve Ackerman and John Martin in just a moment, but I want to let you know tomorrow we're going to continue our series on the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act at 11 o'clock tomorrow. We'll be talking about Kirtland's warblers. And then at 11:45, folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center will be here. They'll be talking about land use change and bioenergy. So some good things coming up tomorrow. And of course, good things coming up right now with Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They are the UW Weather Guys. Thanks so much for joining me, Steve. Great to see you.
It's great to be here on a wonderful day.
And John, you're looking tan and healthy.
Hey, thank you very much.
What am I looking white tan. And pale?
Now, John just has a certain glow today. I don't know. Well, you know, usually he's running in at the last minute.
That's true. This is the first time I haven't been late in 6 months or something.
Yeah, you know, you got to talk to that university. I mean, they've got to have their priorities straight.
You're getting
here on time.
A lot of people in the state think we don't work, but that's wrong. We work, so I'm always late.
You work and you run.
Yeah.
Well, just in case some people might be tuning in for the first time and aren't sure who the Weather Guys are, John Martin is a professor and the chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW and also a professor of atmospheric science. And they come by about once a month, just like clockwork, although usually on a Monday, but with the holiday. Yeah. Maybe that's it, John. Maybe you just look better on Tuesday.
It's Ruby Tuesday. that's right. I'm feeling that way. It's going.
Well, last month, you talked about some tornadoes in other parts of the country, I think especially Oklahoma we were talking about. But since then, there's been at least one in Wisconsin as well. Refresh our memories, Steve. What is a tornado exactly and what conditions produce them?
Oh, boy, good question. A tornado is a rapidly spinning vortex, which I guess is the same thing. Can you have a vortex that doesn't spin? Probably not. Right, no. Yeah. Right.
By definition, there's
definition is
rapidly spinning column of air, maybe.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah. Or a highly rotating vortex.
Yeah.
And they're associated with thunderstorms that usually have a lot of wind shear with them, which means as you go up in the vertical, either the wind changes speed or changes directions. And usually in severe storms that produce tornadoes, it's both. So the whole storm rotates.
Okay.
And then the vortex drops out of the cloud base. And when it touches the ground, it starts doing destruction.
And that's the funnel that we see.
And when it first comes out of the cloud base, that's when you'll see first a funnel. And that's actually water. Droplets that have condensed as they enter into that vortex. But eventually, as that vortex kind of stretches on its way down to the ground, when it touches the ground, then it starts picking up debris.
Okay.
And then that's when we actually define it as a tornado.
And what kind of speeds are we talking about in that vortex?
The fastest go up to 300 miles per hour. And the other ones are probably in 100, you know, the weaker ones, the so-called weaker ones.
Yeah, one that you probably can see, you know, the kind that gets some airplay on a video probably is in the 200 mile per hour range, almost surely.
So I grew up in Chicago, and it feels like there was a tornado watch at least, you know, a couple times a week during the summer and then warnings. We used to always... It felt like right before there was especially a tornado warning, there was this weird green color to the sky in the air, and it got really calm, and you felt like, oh, this isn't good, you know, scamper down to the basement.
The green in the sky is sometimes a signal of ice being in the clouds, suspended ice, and that's usually a function of how intense the storm is itself. So it's refraction of sunlight through ice, and so they're sometimes tied together, and but that there's not always a connection. But
I have to say, my mother was very cautious and would take me down to the basement even for a lot of watches. So I feel like I spent a large portion of my childhood summers in the basement. but you know, they're not something to mess with. And one did go through our neighborhood, and the destruction was pretty incredible.
And I think in Chicago, that's where they had the Plainview tornado went by nearby, you know, which kind of caught people by surprise, or enough warning didn't go out. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, if people thought something might be coming, that they would go down to the basement, which is a safe thing to do.
Yeah, and the risk, you know, factor in a large metropolitan area far exceeds the risk factor in a small rural community, even though people are under the gun in both cases. It's just the density is so much lower in the rural community.
And John, is it possible to predict what kind of a tornado season we'll have, or is it just how the conditions develop?
That's a reasonable question. I think it's probably not. There have been some people who have actually done some research to try and connect, for instance, some of the tropical Pacific sea surface temperature variation that we call El Niño or La Niña to tornado frequency in the central part of the United States. I'm not sure if the signal is very strong, if there's a signal at all. To be quite honest, that's just my recollection. I think that if it had been strong, we'd all be well aware of the fact that it's pretty strong and that there'd be some kind of predictive value there. I don't think there is too much of one there. These are very short-lived, intense storms that have life cycles of less than an hour in many cases and are involved in storms that have life cycles certainly less than 6 hours long. And so
this is not something where it starts as a tropical storm or a tropical depression and then builds and builds like a hurricane.
Right. With a hurricane, you have a 10-day time period where you can watch the thing evolve. Even with a mid-latitude storm, the kind that brings us our winter snow and springtime rain, you can see them evolve over a period of days. Tornadic activity is very short-lived, and it's tied to storms that have short life cycles, so it's really hard to see them coming.
We're talking weather and climate change with the UW-Madison weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join in with a question or comment by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we often get some great weather photos up on our Facebook page, so if you have one, we'd love to see that. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and it's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And Phil in Hebron, Illinois, has a tornado question. Hi, Phil.
Actually, I thought of a second one while I was on hold hearing this.
Well, good thing we didn't leave you any longer.
There you go. I learned in school, or somebody taught me, if you've got hail conditions, in other words, if it's hailing well, are you in conditions for a tornado? Is that perfect tornado conditions? My other one is, now that everybody and his uncle seems to be a storm chaser, and they're getting all these videos on TV, why is it seems a lot of these tornadic videos, if you look at the sky, sometimes surrounding, sometimes behind the tornado, it's a very clear blue sky. Hmm. What's going on there?
Hmm. So hail, and then why blue skies?
Yeah. So both hail and tornadoes require the same type of atmospheric conditions, very unstable air, cooler air above, warm, moist air there near the ground, and then a vertical wind shear. But you don't always get them together.
Right.
So they're kind of similar conditions needed, but they don't always generate the same.
So there's not a causal effect, but they might both develop because of similar conditions.
They're both in severe thunderstorm environments. And then the blue sky on the backside of these really intense thunderstorms that can spawn tornadoes is not at all uncommon. It's more common to the southwest of us in the central plains and southern plains, where the air along the line along which the thunderstorms forms is a boundary that's got a really strong boundary of moist air on one side and very dry air on the other side. And so a lot of these thunderstorm storms that are producing tornadoes, tornado-producing severe storms, will have perfectly clear skies on their backside. Hmm. And the tornado tends to form on the backside of a thunderstorm anyway. But up here in the Midwest, the higher, northern plains, western Great Lakes states, we tend to be in a place where you don't really get that extraordinary dry air to our west. And so sometimes the tornado landscape here is going to have clouds across the whole sky. But down in the southwest, it's not uncommon at all for them to be on the border of clear skies.
And I want to make it perfectly clear that I do not chase tornadoes.
Yeah,
so
neither
not
do
everyone.
Neither do I.
I run away.
They may chase you,
I'm
but
like
you
your mother.
I'm
down
in
the
basement.
Yeah,
I have to say, perhaps I'm here today because she was so cautious. So I'm not at all, dissing that. But it was. It just felt like, oh, time to go down in the basement, grab my books, grab my toys. But so you just talked about the Great Plains, John, and certainly the Great Plains and the Midwest seem like tornado central. What is it about the middle of the country that we seem more prone to them?
Yeah, Steve just mentioned the ingredients, and there's no place else on the planet Earth where these two ingredients are so closely, proximate to one another. You need very, very moist air in the lowest part of the atmosphere, and you tend to need really dry, warm air in the middle part of the atmosphere, and they have to sit on top of each other. And then they have to be sitting on top of each other, preceding some disturbance that'll come by that'll kind of trigger the vertical motions that can drive the thunderstorm development. The only reason why the warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico moves northward into the central plains of the United States and really dry, warm air moves out across the plains at mid-levels in the atmosphere in our part of the world is because that's generated by a mid-level weather disturbance that will actually set all those ingredients in place over the central United States, and then also provide the trigger to have the air rise. So it's perfect. There's no place else like it.
Ooh, we're so lucky.
Spain and southern France have the Sahara, but that's not as elevated as the Mexican Plateau, and then parts of India also can get them because the Himalaya is adjacent to them, but it's no place like the central United States.
We got just the right geography.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Right? Just
that,
in the right
That should
spot.
Be a new tourism.
There was a guy named Davies who wrote a book called Storm Country, and his thesis was, and the book didn't really work for me, but his thesis was people in the central United States, their worldview is altered by the fact that they have to face these devastating storms. And he talked about that. Very interesting.
Except that I think that, you know, depending on where you're from, so if you're from the East Coast, you think hurricanes are, you know, kind of a fact of life. Central United States, you think, ah, tornadoes, you know, we get them every year. And the West Coast, you think, well, an occasional earthquake isn't going to kill you. So I think it's what you, you know, what you grew up with is thinking of part of the normal landscape that, you know. But
actually, I grew up on Long Island and never really thought about tornadoes.
Right.
But hurricanes,
But then you
always
come to the Midwest, it's like, oh, tornadoes.
Right, yeah, no, who thinks of hurricanes?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's whatever you're familiar with seems like the more manageable one. Well, there's a lot to talk about with the weather, climate change. There's been some interesting stuff going on. NASA scientist James Hansen has gone on record talking about climate change and natural disasters. But we're going to have to wait to come back with the weather guys to talk about that. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, weather is really the backdrop for everything we do, and sometimes it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mealer. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Whether it's lack of rain or so much that it causes flooding or unusual temperatures on either end of the thermometer, we have to respect the power weather has. And this time of year, especially here in the Midwest, that can mean tornadoes. No matter what's going on, weather is always fascinating, and we're lucky to have the weather guys from UW Madison here for the next half hour to explain it. Steve Ackerman and John Martin will share their knowledge of climate and weather, and they're happy to answer your questions when you call 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget our Facebook page to post your comments and weather photos, too. If you like the page while you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back in just a couple minutes with the weather guys, so I hope you'll stay tuned. We're back right after this look at the news. Well, weather fascinates us, and maybe it's because it seems to be one of the few things that human beings really have not figured out how to control. And certainly when there are spectacular displays like blizzards, tornadoes, or even rainbows, it gets our attention. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mealer. Glad you could join us. And we're enjoying our regular monthly visit with the UW Weather Guys, John Martin, Professor and Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be here, Judith.
And Steve Ackerman is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and also a professor of atmospheric sciences. Great to have you back, Steve.
It's great to be back. And you can just refer to it as SIMS.
SIMS.
It's a lot easier to see.
All right. You know, I always feel a sense of accomplishment when I it rolls off
twister.
The tongue. Exactly. Well, you know, we actually have some folks that have been waiting to talk with you. So let's go to the phones first. Chris in Trempolo is on next. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What's your question or story?
Well, it's more of a story. I was driving through the Southern Ozarks in the Jonesboro, Arkansas area probably about 10 years ago with my cousin. And we were driving through. It was kind of rainy, a little mild storm going through, no big deal. When I looked off probably two peaks over, I saw a funnel cloud coming down. And no sooner did I see it, and the weather warning came over the radio. I was like, yep, thanks for the advance warning, guys. I pulled the car over to the side of the road, hit the ditch, and the tornado, when it touched down, actually jumped from one peak, which was to my immediate left, or right off the front of the car, to the peak right behind me. So it jumped right over the top of me. And I tell you, that was probably the closest I ever came to needing a diaper change.
I've not heard of the of bouncing from peak to peak, but I will say this: that's even easier to understand or to conceptualize than the kind that you sometimes hear about tornadoes bouncing over the plains. They'll actually leave the ground, come back down in another spot, almost like a slinky, you know,
like,
moving
or skipping.
Right. Non-discrete motion, and so this is fairly common. I bet you it's even more common for the rare tornadoes that occur in places that are rather mountainous, like northwestern Arkansas.
Going
That's
from
really
high,
interesting.
Yeah, high point to high point.
Yeah,
wow.
And it does provide you a nice, you know, story as well as a good place to be safe. Get in the valleys.
There you
between
go.
The peaks.
Oh, Chris,
but
we're
just
glad
to
you're still
add
with
to
us.
That. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Steve.
tornadoes will occur in valleys. So don't think because you're in a valley that you're safe. Right, yeah.
That you can just watch it pass overhead.
Right, yeah, just get out on the roadway and look.
Well, Orville in Madison has another tornado question. Let's go there. Hi, Orville.
Hi. I just finished reading Stefan Ramstorff's book on Threatened Oceans. Are you aware of the book?
I am not. Could you repeat the author again?
Stefan Ramstorff.
No, I don't know that name.
Anyway, I have my head filled with terms that I don't understand. Can you say something about the relationship between tornadoes and cyclones or anticyclones and atmospheric lifting? And what is the Coriolis force?
Okay. So I'll take the first couple. What you
sure,
can think
good.
About the Coriolis. Count Coriolis. Relationship between tornadoes and cyclones and anticyclones. The best way to get to this answer is to first define what cyclones and anticyclones are. In our hemisphere, cyclones are storms around which, they're very large storms, sometimes as large as 10 states, last for about a week, have varying intensity over that period of a week. They have circulations around their centers that are counterclockwise on a very broad scale, 10 state, half the continent scale. Within those storms, there are regions of intense precipitation generation called fronts. And occasionally, especially in the spring and summer, those fronts can be the spots at which severe thunderstorm activity can be initiated, and then you have a threat of a tornado. There's almost no relationship between tornadoes and anticyclones, which are regions of clear skies, nice weather, benign winds. And around those big circulation systems, again, 10 states or more in size, the flow of air in our hemisphere will be clockwise. And so those are associated with nice weather for us, not severe storms. So very often severe storms will occur somewhere in the vicinity or on the outskirts of a cyclone. That's a common relationship. And then the Coriolis force.
Yeah, and so the Coriolis force is what we called an apparent force, in the sense that it's really not there. But it looks like it's there. And so if we didn't know better, we would think that we're still, and we're on a reference frame in terms of how we look at everything that isn't moving. But of course, the Earth is moving and it's spinning. And because of that spinning movement, objects that are still traveling in a straight line look like they're moving. And so in order to explain that, rather than go through the mathematics of making our reference system spin, we make our reference system still and then just add this apparent force. And in this case, it's named after a guy named Coriolis, a French guy. And one of the ways they found out about it was shooting artillery. So I guess it was a war in France. I don't remember which one.
Yeah.
But they would be aiming for the city, knowing that the artillery shells should travel in a straight line. But they kept moving to the right. And then eventually they realized, oh, something's kind of odd here.
Hmm.
And they ended up describing the mathematical formulas to predict how far to the right that actually should go. And that's come up with the Coriolis force.
Yeah.
Did that answer your questions, Orville?
The other one was atmospheric lifting. Why does the tornado go up? Air lift?
No, air lifts for a variety of reasons. It has to be forced to lift. And one of the more common ways in the context of the cyclone that I just described is air rising at frontal boundaries. So at the boundary between the cold front and the warm air ahead of it, the air tends to rise in the vertical, goes from low elevation to higher elevation. And then also at the warm front, though less abruptly. And anytime the air rises, it cools because it expands into the lower pressure environment that it's moving into. And as it cools, its relative humidity increases. And so that's how you can actually take invisible water vapor in an air parcel, lift it to a higher elevation. It cools by expansion, and that water vapor can suddenly start to condense or turn to ice, and you can see it as either a cloud droplet or a piece of ice in the cloud. And this doesn't happen to just one isolated air parcel. It happens to huge amounts of air, and so you get big cloud development that's going on when the air rises. But it's a key ingredient to produce clouds. It's the key ingredient. Hmm. You have to have the air rising to produce a cloud.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thanks for that call, Orville. And if you have a question for the weather guys, you can join in. Call 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. 1234. And William posted on our Facebook page, I like the rare and strange weather phenomenon. I have seen the light pillars in winter, saw red lightning some years ago, but have not been able to confirm that it indeed happens. Also, has there ever been a snow tornado? Is there any other kind of extreme rare and strange weather I could look for?
I don't know about a snow tornado. That's an interesting,
I know that the famous event in Janesville, was it November 11th, 1911, where they had a tornado earlier in the day followed by 6 inches of snow. So this was a passage of an extreme cold front that on the warm side of it had a tornado, and then on the cold side of it, a snow squall that dropped 6 or 7 inches of snow. They were cleaning the city up while it was still snowing after this tornado. So they happened within hours of each other. I don't know if they happened at the same time.
I would bet it would be tough to get them to occur at the same time.
I would think
just because
so
you need that warm, moist air near the ground for the tornado. And it's probably can't get snow that way.
I would think so, too.
And what's the red lightning that William's referring to?
I don't know.
So there's there's regular bolts that we see, and a lot of times they look, white as they flash and saturate our eyeballs. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they have a purple tint to them. But then also at the tops of clouds, they also have other lightning-type features, and those can be red or blue. Those are the sprites. Right, and the elves and things like that. And so, but those are really rare to see, particularly from the ground. So maybe that's
what he's referring to.
I have to say, I really like thunder snow.
Thunder snow is cool.
It is. It's great. And it's really not so hard to understand. It just doesn't happen that frequently because of what Steve said, the conditions are a little bit off.
Yeah.
And not particularly dangerous, which adds.
No.
You can just enjoy it. You don't have to go to the basement.
That's right. Yeah. You can go outside, hear that muffled sound.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go to Dale in Eau Claire. Hi, Dale.
Hi. Greetings. See, there's something that is, I think, has been described as being a cloud street where there are rolls of clouds. They're not actually rolling, but they seem to be spaced so that there's some distance from each other. But they move along, and I've always been curious. They're very pretty. Usually it's in nice weather, not in foul weather. But what gets that phenomenon started, and why don't they mix together and become a solid cloud rather than stay widely separated as they move across the sky?
It's most likely a function of the fact that what you're seeing is one half of an alternating set of updrafts and downdrafts of air. And so the only one that you can see is where the clouds are. And then in the adjacent clear spots around each of those clouds in a so-called cloud street, those are probably regions where the air is sinking. And so there's a number of ways that such a thing can develop. One of the more cool ways, actually, is you'll notice sometimes these cloud streets actually look like the sand in a riverbed, don't they? Exactly the same kind of thing. And you get this flow of the atmosphere instead of the water just bouncing up and down because of a variety of circumstances, maybe differences in stability, maybe differences in something underlying in the topography or something. And where the air is going up, it's easy to form a cloud if the humidity conditions are right. Where the air is going down, the cloud disappears. And yet you'll have this fairly constant separation between the alternating clear and cloud bands in these streets. So that's only one explanation. There's many different mechanisms that can lead to it, but that's really one of the underlying things that's going on there.
And it's not convective in starting it, then. It's flowing over something and getting almost a bounce start.
Right. It's almost certainly not convective because convective motions become free. They act on their own once they get past a certain stage. And these are more forced motions, steadily forced motions. And it really is a bouncing or a little bit of a ripple in a stream of air that you can get something going like that.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen a cloud street.
Well, you probably have, but it's a word they haven't used before because it's one that I don't really know what to call it when I see it either, but just something that looks like sand in a river.
Okay.
They're just like rows of clouds.
Rows of clouds.
Evenly
spaced. And
maybe I'm not looking up often enough.
Well, they don't occur that often around here. I mean, you do see them in the wintertime a lot over the Great Lakes. They develop.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like a circular motion.
That's another way to develop
them. Oh, okay.
And those will often come together, so many miles downwind.
Give it enough time, they will, yeah. That's right.
Okay. Well, there was a comment or question on our Facebook page from Kyle. Has climate change affected the winds? It seems to be getting windier.
I guess it probably means winds at the surface of the planet, which we experience, I guess. I'm not so sure about that. I don't know if people have really come up with a solid answer to that question or not.
You know, I went on the state climatologist webpage and looked at this because this has come up a couple of times. Yeah. And it's, you know, wind measurements are so related to our experiences that we remember them.
Yeah.
And looking at their plots in Madison, it looked like the wind did pick up a lot, like in the 90s, I think.
Is that right?
And so I had asked Ed Hopkins, who's one of the assistant state climatologists, about what this was.
Yeah.
And he thought it had to do with the changing of the weather stations, going from the ASOS, you know, from the people observations to an automated observation. So...
So it's not the data that's changing or the conditions.
It might not be. So it's one of those questions, where you really got to make sure you get the right data and then you look at it in the right way. And, you know, when Ed said that to me, I was just like, oh, okay, that's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work to make that translation because that's what have to do with surface observations to make a climate record. Is if things are moving around, you have to make the adjustment. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it intelligently, which is always done, but it is an enormous amount of work.
Yeah.
Sure. So that might be why that question hasn't really been addressed.
Unless he's moved onto the lake and then downwind of a lake, and then it will have gotten windier.
There you go. Well, thanks for that comment, Kyle. And actually, that brings up NASA scientist James Hansen, who has been one of the leading voices on climate change and saying that there is human contributions affecting climate change. He's gone on record recently to tie climate change to what were previously considered natural disasters. He's saying, for instance, that the extreme weather like last year's scorching heat waves in places like Texas and Russia are in fact caused by global warming. And this is a departure in that he's saying that they did have human contributions to it, not just that it could have had an impact. What does this mean, and why is he now kind of, you know, going out on a limb a little bit?
Yeah, so he's been attributing human impact on climate change for a long time now. I mean, he first did congressional testimony in the late 1980s to point it out because it was the physics is there, and all we needed now back then was a real signature to see those observations. But now he's coming out and pointing out that, if you see any one particular event, it's impossible to attribute that to global warming, or even if the Earth were cooling, to attribute it to a climate change. So the arguments that he's now pointing out is that, you know, it's not just about one event. It's about 15,000 warm temperature record set in the U.S. in March. So when you start looking at that statistically, now that, you know, global warming, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years, has really been increasing, we're seeing a shift in the distribution. So it's not just about the mean that's occurring, but if you take that typical bell curve that we often talk about in assigning grades, you know, it's that mean is not just moving from a B to an AB. So the number of A's is going up and the number of D's is going down because that whole shape shifts.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, it's a tricky business, though, to really say that conclusively that what happened in March is a function of a changing climate. It very well could be. I'd be surprised if in the end when we all get, great enlightenment, that we don't come to the conclusion that, this was exactly right. I'd be so surprised that's not the case. However, I would be hard-pressed to make a defense of it right now. Mm-hmm. But we're working on this exact problem. My research group is looking at the month of March and saying, do we see anything here that we just can't find in the last 50 years and any other record over North America? And not just surface temperature, but a lot of things. And to the extent that that turns out to be true, it's going to be awfully hard for skeptics to argue that this is not the case, that this extraordinary month of March, as one example of a global climate anomaly, is not related to a changing climate.
It seems like there are more climate change skeptics in the U.S. than in other parts of the world. Is that
they're better
accurate?
Funded. It's a simple answer. They're better funded. And they're funded by people with a vested interest in denying that this is really a problem. So I think that's what you're getting at.
Right.
And you don't have that attack in Europe in general in terms of attacking science, if you will.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's go back to the phones and Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. I have a scanner, and occasionally when I hear, they're talking about cloud-to-ground lightning.
Hmm.
What makes it different? What conditions are there that produce it? And should you be a lot more careful about being out or whatever?
There are basic three types of lightning in the types of bolts that we're talking about. The one, as you just pointed out, is cloud to ground, and that means it's going from the cloud to the ground. I mean, it's that connection. There's also cloud to cloud, so it can go from one cloud to another cloud, or there's within a cloud. So all the lightning bolts occur within a cloud. Typically, what we measure is the cloud-to-ground lightning strokes. Those are the ones that most detectors will pick up. I don't think it's any different than cloud-to-cloud or, you know, within a cloud in terms of the processes that form that huge electric spark, which is one way to think about it. It's usually a lot more dangerous just because there's more people on the ground. And if you get hit in a plane, the planes are insulated against that and it will protect you.
And there's different polarities to lightning, and people study this, and it's kind of interesting that there's different species of lightning when it comes to the polarity of the shock.
Yeah,
the
so there's positive lightning.
And negatives. Yeah. Which is weird. I don't really know any more than that. I just know that it's true.
Yeah, so in the normal lightning, I think the ground becomes positively charged, and the bottom of the cloud becomes negatively charged.
Yeah,
and so that determines
yeah.
the stroke. Yeah. In the positive lightning, it switches around. And so the ground becomes negatively charged, and the lightning and the cloud becomes positively charged. And for some reason, and I don't think they know why yet, those positive lightning ones tend to be stronger, if you will, more intense.
Those are the kind of things that are just real mysteries still.
So was it positive or negative lightning that was in Young Frankenstein and brought the monster to life?
I mean, that's, that I can neither confirm nor deny that.
All right.
That was life-giving lightning.
Life-giving lightning. Christopher emailed to ask what the correlation is, if any, between tornadoes and dust devils.
Oh, two totally different processes.
Yeah.
Okay. So tornadoes occur in severe weather, thunderstorms, clouds, and they come from the cloud base down to the ground. Dust storms occur in cloud-free skies where you have solar heating of the ground, and then that calls a whirlwind that picks up dust and makes
it visible. And that's a dust devil.
And that's a dust devil. And they can get pretty big. They can get a mile high.
Yeah.
And,
wow.
Yeah. They don't get up to wind speeds of you know, hundreds of miles per hour. They're probably only tens or so.
Yeah, they're not dangerous. But one of my roommates as a graduate student would drive from Seattle down to northern Nevada on certain long weekends just to watch these things. Because there's certain places where you can predict they're going to happen. You know, if it's sunny and warm, as Steve was saying, you're going to get these dust devils.
Yeah.
And they're really quite dramatic.
And you get them on Mars.
Not dangerous.
They've seen them on Mars, too.
Oh, right.
So it's the same process.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Thanks for that question, Christopher. And Lauren in Homan is next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. In 1984, I was in Kenya, and my daughter and I got up real early in the morning at sunrise to take some pictures, and it was a clear day, no wind, anything like that. But about the time of sunrise, everything turned bright red. And it only lasted for a minute or two, and then, boom, the normal coloration returned. And I wondered if you might have any explanation for that.
Steve and John are looking at each other.
Were you in the city? Were you in Nairobi, or were you out in the country?
No, we were out in the Serengeti.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder if it's dust.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah,
because
dust
likes to scatter red light. And when the sun is rising, you know, usually it's red anyway because the blues have already been removed.
Yeah.
And it was probably a very thin dust layer, so you probably didn't notice it except when the sun was low.
Yeah, and it just
makes the sky look red,
better.
And then as soon as it gets higher, it's just not enough dust there to turn the sky red.
I think some of those hot days, even here in our part of the world, my cousins lived on a farm in Indiana when I was in my teens, and we went out and visited them once, and it was a really hot week. And not a particularly windy week. It wasn't obviously windy, but you know how a warm day stirs the air up a little bit. It must have been dusty enough that every sunrise was red, and the sky itself was red, not just the sun. It was one of those things. So that's what made me think of dust right away.
Right, yeah. That's our guess.
That's your more or less informed guess.
Yeah, but I think we should go to Kenya.
There you go. There must be a grant out there
work.
Or something.
Right.
Yeah. Well, as always, it's been a lot of fun talking with John Martin and Steve Ackerman about the weather. Steve, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it was great. The time flew by.
It did. And John, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Judith. Same here.
And we'll be back on your Monday schedule, the last Monday of the month. So June 25th will be the next time.
All right.
Yippee.
It sounds like far off, but I guess June starts Friday, right? It'll creep up. Well, thanks to Steve and John for joining us. Thanks to Marika Suval for answering the phones today. Tomorrow at 11, we'll continue our series on the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act, and we're going to be taking a look at Kirtland's warblers, a really interesting tiny bird that is nesting and setting up its territory right now in the month of May. And then at 11:45 tomorrow, folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center are here to talk about land use change and bioenergy. And looking forward to Thursday, we're going to be talking food. We'll be talking about getting kids interested in cooking and good eating and a little bit of culinary history you can share with them at the same time. And then we'll be talking with the author of Eat More Vegetables. She has great ways to use seasonal produce, whether it's from your CSA box or just that you're trying to buy locally or seasonally at the grocery store. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mailer. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and we'll stay tuned for a lot more great programming on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.